Now, Matthew has been called by A.T. Robertson probably the most useful book ever written. It covers, and I wrote this in the front of the book of Matthew in my Bible, it comes first in the New Testament collection and has done more than any other to create the impression of Jesus the world has obtained. You know, if someone's going to read the New Testament, most times they're going to start with Matthew, and even if they don't complete it, this is the most likely book that they will be able to complete, and therefore the book that will give them the most information, has given the world its first impression of Jesus through the years. And what we're going to do in this class is just look at, go ahead and advance if you will, and one more time. If you were flying in an airplane at 50,000 feet above the earth, you would only be able to see the largest landmarks. You'd be able to see the mountains. You might be able to see large cities at a distance. You'd just see the large landmarks. And when you look at the Bible from that perspective, from a distance, you see that it is divided into four sections. That is the New Testament. 4:1, 21:1. That's good to commit to memory. Four biographies of Jesus. One book of the history of the church. The book of Acts. 21 letters. And then one book of prophecy, the book of Revelation. That's easy to remember, 4:1, 21:1, that gives you the structure of the New Testament. And in that first section, you have these four books, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and each one of them gives us a different impression of Jesus. Much of the material that they cover is the same, because they're dealing with the same life, but it is remarkable the differences in each one. In Matthew, you have Well, let's look at the overview. Go ahead and put the next three up there, if you will. Go ahead and cover that before we move. Matthew to John, why believe in Jesus. The book of Acts, how to become a Christian. The books of Romans through Jude, how to live as a Christian. And then the book of Revelation, where a Christian goes when he dies. That's the structure of the New Testament. I've started preaching in gospel meetings that is a sermon. The New Testament as a guide to going to heaven. And it's very interesting to study it from that perspective, from the 50,000 foot perspective where you just see the highlights. And now we talk about the 25,000 feet view, which is just looking at these first four books. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. In Matthew, Jesus is presented as the King of the Jews. It's a bridge between the Old Testament and the New Testament. The Old Testament was written to the Jews, and the Jews were familiar with it, knew its prophecies, and they were watching to see this one who was to come. The Old Testament closes in Malachi 3 and 4, saying, I'm going to send a forerunner or one to announce that the Messiah has arrived. And so the Jews were watching for that, but you know, it had been a long time. The last book of the Old Testament ended 400 years before John steps out of the wilderness and begins to preach the kingdom of heaven is at hand. So even though it's just one page or maybe two pages to turn in our Bibles, you're passing over 400 years of history. And so when during that intervening time, there had been some who had made false claims to be the Messiah, and the Jews rejected them. And now Jesus comes, and the question is he really the one? Well, Matthew presents him as the fulfillment of the Old Testament prophecies. It presents him as the King of Israel. And then Mark, Jesus is the servant of man, written primarily to the Romans. And then Luke, Jesus is the Son of Man, emphasizing his humanity, written to the Greeks. And then John, written later and written to the church or to all men, Jesus is the Son of God. Now, let's go down a little bit closer to the New Testament and look at just the book of Matthew. The book of Matthew presenting Jesus as the King. Can you imagine a strong-voiced man stepping out of the castle and announcing to a large crowd, now presenting the King? And the King comes out dressed in his regal garb with his crown. And that's what Matthew is doing in this first book of the New Testament, now presenting the earth's King. Go ahead and put all the words on this slide up, if you will. There are 8 emphases in the book of Matthew showing that Jesus is the King. In 2:2, the question is asked, where is he that is born King of the Jews? Born to be a king. The wise men were looking for a king. In chapter 21, verse 5, behold, the king cometh to thee riding upon a colt, the foal of a donkey. And so that's the triumphant entry. Jesus comes in, not as might be expected of a king on a white stallion, but instead coming in as a humble king riding on a colt or the foal of an ass or a donkey. 25:34, in Jesus' great Olivet discourse, he says, then shall the king say to those on his right hand, the king will pronounce judgment. 25:40, and the king shall answer again. You see, the king is making his judgments. And then these four from the latter part of the book of Matthew, Jesus was asked, art thou the king? The king. You see, that's what people were saying about him. Pilate was curious. Was he? Was he not? 27:29, hail king of the Jews, as they mocked him. 27:37, which is the key verse of the book, that placard or titleist that was above his cross, Jesus the king of the Jews. And then, it doesn't use the word king, but 28:18, as the book closes, all authority hath been given unto me in heaven and on earth. Go ye therefore and teach all nations. So there is the commission given by the king to his kingdom, to the church. So that's the emphasis in the book of Matthew. Jesus is presented as the king. Now let's advance to the next slide and see the 10,000 feet view of the New Testament or the book of Matthew. You're coming in a little closer. You can see more detail than you could at that greater height. And so in the book of Matthew, you really have three sections to the book. You have the introduction, chapters 1-4, and then you have the Galilean ministry. The Galilee is the northern part of Israel, where Nazareth was, where Jesus grew up, where Capernaum was, which was his headquarters for much of his preaching career. Most of his miracles and sermons were preached in Galilee. And so in the middle section of the book, you have Jesus preaching among his own people in that part of the land. Go ahead. Would one of you come up here? It'd probably be easier if we could get this to work, because this one's really relies on slides a lot more than some. All right, in the first four chapters, I'm not going to spend a lot of time in this because we've studied these chapters before. But if you just wanted to give each one a title in chapters 1, 2, 3, and 4, you just need to remember one word in each one. Jesus' birth is chapter 1. It's a birth unlike any other. The virgin birth of Jesus Christ, Mary, his mother, Joseph, his stepfather, and the details. Matthew actually deals with it from the perspective of his stepfather, Joseph. Luke deals with it from Mary's perspective. But in this chapter, you have the quandary that Joseph has. What am I supposed to do? My wife-to-be, we haven't come together yet, but she is expecting a child. Should I put her away? Should I keep her? Should I have her executed because she's broken the law, or at least it appears that she has. And so that's when the angel appears to him. So that's chapter 1. You have the pedigree of the king and all those names, 42 names given there that trace Jesus back, Jesus' ancestry back from Joseph all the way back to Abraham, who was the father of the Jews, written to the Jews. It makes sense they would want to see how this man who claims to be the king is related to King David and to Abraham, the father of our nation. Chapter 2 is about his boyhood, mostly just about his early boyhood, when the Magi or the wise men come to visit, bringing their gifts. And then Herod hears from them about a king being born, and then he tries to kill Jesus. He is unable to pinpoint exactly who he is and where he is, so he kills all the babies in and around Bethlehem. But Jesus' parents had already been warned to leave, and so they've gone down into Egypt, and Jesus escapes. But that's his boyhood. We don't know much about his boyhood, especially from age 2 to age 12. But he grew up, according to Luke 2:52, in wisdom, stature, favor with God and man. So he grew up as other boys do, except for he was a perfect boy. And then in chapter 3, we studied last week, it's the ministry of John the Baptist, and the latter part of that chapter is the baptism of Jesus. Chapter 4, you could call the battle or the duel in the desert, because there you have Satan attempting to get Jesus to sin, those three great avenues of temptation that we all face. But each time Jesus answered, "It is written, it is written, it is written," and he defeated the devil. So that's the introduction to the book. The book is going to cover about 34 years of time, because Jesus lived to be about 33, and it begins at his conception. So you have about 34 years covered. There are 1,071 verses, and the main section, the two main sections deal with, after covering these preliminaries, his teaching ministry. What he did, what he said, what the reaction of the people was, and then his sacrifice for the people. That's the introduction. Now, let's move into the Galilean ministry. I think I have mentioned this before, and so if you have already marked this, then you will know where this verse is, but others in here were not, I'm sure. You need to mark in chapter 4 and verse 12, the last four words, "He departed into Galilee." That's a key section of the book, because that begins the Galilean ministry that will continue all the way to the end of chapter 18. You might also make a note between verse 11 and verse 12 that John 1 through 5 fits here. John 1 through 5 covers the first year of Jesus' ministry. And Jesus, that's not covered in Matthew, but it's not covered in the others, but it is covered in John. So we don't have much information about that. But that's where it would fit. So you're skipping a year between verse 11 and verse 12, that first year of Jesus' ministry. Now, I want an outline of the Galilean ministry. It would be, actually, I'll correct the third one if you're writing these down, but go ahead and start on the first one. What Jesus taught is Matthew chapter 4, 12, the beginning of Galilean ministry until the end of the Sermon on the Mount, where they were astonished at his doctrine. That's chapters 4, 12 through 7, 29. And then what Jesus wrought, or his miracles, there are 12 miracles in, I'm sorry, I must have topped that when I was asleep. Okay, that's 4:12 through 7:29. That's correct. What Jesus wrought should be chapters 8 through 10. And then what the people thought is chapters 11 through 18. So make that correction if you're jotting them down. Chapter 4:12 through 7:29. And then chapters 8 through 10. Then chapters 11 through 18 are the divisions of the Galilean ministry. We'll look more at that. But let me go ahead and give you the structure of the rest of the book, and we'll come back to the Galilean ministry. The second half of the book is very simple. You have the Judean ministry, where Jesus went back to the south. Turn over to chapter 19, verse 1. You'll also need to mark this transition statement. You remember he departed into Galilee, so he's going north. He's going up to his home area. But in chapter 19, Jesus is now going back to the south. His Judean ministry begins. And you notice it says in the middle part of the verse, these four words, "He departed from Galilee." So he's now leaving the Galilean ministry and came into the coast of Judea, beyond Jordan. So he is heading toward Jerusalem, where he will be killed. And so in chapters 19 to 25, you have the presentation of Jesus to Israel. Chapters 26 and 27 is crucifixion. Chapter 28 is resurrection. That's all I'll say about that. It may be in 2 weeks, I hope, to come back and cover that Judean ministry. But today we're going to focus on one section of the Galilean ministry primarily. But let's look at this 5,000 feet view. I mentioned these four as we were covering them. I'll just put them on the screen quickly. From Joseph's perspective, Jesus' birth is chapter 1. The wise men and the evil king is chapter 2. Baptism of Jesus is John the Baptist's role in Jesus' early life. I might mention on that one that chapter 3 of Matthew tells us about John in the early part and how he came on the scene wearing unusual clothes, a leather girdle, and a garment made out of camel's hair. And he ate unusual food, grasshoppers or locusts and wild honey. He preached not in a church building or a synagogue or the temple. He preached out in the woods, out in the wilderness, down by the river. But he was such a powerful preacher that people would leave the comfort of their homes and their cities, and they would walk into the woods where he was preaching, and then they would listen to him preach to them to repent, and then he baptized thousands of people in the River Jordan. And the record of that is found in Matthew 3, and then Jesus, of course, came to him at that same location, and he was baptized to begin his ministry. And then the duel in the desert in chapter 4, where Satan comes to Jesus at his weakest moment and tries to tempt him to change the bread, the rocks into bread, to jump from the pinnacle of the temple, and then to bow down and worship him and be given all the kingdoms of the earth. And Jesus resisted those temptations. So that's the first four chapters. And then you move into where we want to spend the balance of our time in this class, what Jesus taught and what Jesus wrought, his words and his wonders. Yes. Okay, chapter 2. That's what I think. Yeah, that's one of those, a lot of mistakes that are made in the, quote, Christmas story, you know, that people just perpetuate because they've always seen that. But that's one of them, and that is, there may have only been two, there may have been ten, but they did bring three gifts, and so it's usually assumed each man had a gift. So it could have been three. It's not necessarily wrong. It's just we're not given that information. That's a good question. That's true. All right, let's go then into chapters 5 through 7. This is the Sermon on the Mount. Before we get to chapter 5, though, stop at verse 17 of chapter 4, and let's see Jesus beginning to teach. And from that time, Jesus began to teach and to say. So Jesus came into the world as a teacher. He's called teacher 41 times in the New Testament. 23 times he calls himself a teacher. 12 times his friends or disciples refer to him as teacher. And 6 times his enemies call him a teacher. There's never been another teacher like Jesus, the most remarkable teacher the world has ever seen. By the time Jesus came, the three greatest philosophers who would ever live had already lived. Socrates taught for 40 years. Plato for 50 years, Aristotle for 40 years. But the combined 120 years of their teaching doesn't even register on the same scale with the 3.5 years that Jesus was an itinerant teacher in and around Judea. It's remarkable that Jesus, a humble man who never traveled more than 200 miles from the place of his birth, would have such influence that he's known throughout the earth in every generation. And his teachings are known. If I ask you, could you tell me anything that Aristotle ever said? Plato? Socrates? I know some of you are just being humble and not speaking up because you might be able to remember one thing that one of those philosophers said. Others of us are scratching our heads thinking, I've heard of him, but, you know, I don't really. But you could go out here on the street. You can go to Walmart. You can go to New York City. You can go to China. And you can ask, can you tell me anything that Jesus ever said? And even people that are irreligious, atheists, can tell you something Jesus said. The parable of the Good Samaritan, the prodigal son, God so loved the world he gave his only begotten son. Judge not that you be not judged. I mean, people know what Jesus said. What a remarkable teacher he was. That's all I'll say about chapter 4, but I do want to look at chapters 5, 6, and 7 with you. I've been reading this over and over and just coming to some of my own conclusions rather than just those that others have had based on it. And it seems to me that if you wanted to outline the Sermon on the Mount, and the easiest way to do that would just be by the chapters that you have. You have three chapters and you have three primary emphases. I'm going to put that on the screen without going over it, except just to give the references for the audio. The Jesus as a rabbi or a teacher in the book of Matthew 4:17-23, chapter 5, verse 1, when he sits down to teach the Sermon on the Mount, 7:28-29, the conclusion of the Sermon on the Mount, 9:35, and then 11:1, the emphasis on Jesus as a teacher. Now, when you get to Matthew chapter 5, and you have in this the most remarkable, the beginning of the most remarkable sermon in the New Testament, the Sermon on the Mount is sometimes called the Constitution of Christianity. And the theme of it is righteousness. You see, John came preaching, repent. Jesus came preaching, repent. They had the law of God, which was righteous, righteousness revealed, at least to some degree. But they were not following it. They had mixed their traditions with it, and the emphasis was in the wrong place. And so Jesus comes showing them in his first sermon what righteousness truly is. And so if you wanted to give a title to chapter 5, call it True Righteousness, because you have in this section a contrast between the righteousness that was being shown to them by the Pharisees and the righteousness that came out of the law that Jesus came to present. True righteousness. I'm putting some other things up for you that I won't cover because I know some of you like to take additional. You can think faster than I can talk, so you can listen to me and write down these other notes if you want them. If you don't, then just listen to what we're saying. But that particular slide is about the five key discourses in the book of Matthew, the great speeches Jesus made, of which this one is the first. Now, if you were going to look at Matthew chapter 5, you have in the first section the Beatitudes, verses 1 through 12. And then you have the importance of our influence. You see, these are Jesus' first words to the world. I mean, his first full sermon to the world. And so he's saying, this is how to be happy. Well, that's a place to make a good connection with just about anybody. Who doesn't want to be happy? Who doesn't want to enjoy life? Jesus said, this is the way to do that. And then he said, you need to be careful about your influence because you're touching other lives every day. That's verses 13 through 16. And then he gives his relation to the law. To a key verse is verse number 20, really the key verse of the entire Sermon on the Mount. For I say unto you that except your righteousness, you see, that's what Sermon on the Mount's about. It's about righteousness. Except your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, ye shall in no case enter into the kingdom of heaven. Think about that for a minute. From their perspective, the Pharisees were the most righteous people in that culture. I mean, they were the teachers of the law. They were the ones that everybody went to with their questions. They were the ones that the Pharisees were separatists. They separated from every form, at least from their perspective, every form of sin or evil. They would not interact with those that they considered to be sinners. And now Jesus comes and accepts you're more righteous than the Pharisees. You can't go to heaven. Well, that just closed the door for everybody then. I mean, the Pharisees are the most righteous. I could not be more righteous than them. But that's not what Jesus was saying. What he was saying is they are outwardly righteous. They appear to men to be righteous, but inwardly, they're far from me. And Jesus came to emphasize righteousness from the inside out instead of the outside in. It's a lot easier to, you know, look the part, to play the role, to sit in a pew and sing, you know, wear our nice Sunday clothes, but it's a lot harder to live it out in a day by day, every circumstance and situation we come into to have righteousness in the heart that guides our interactions, our words, and what we do and how we treat others. So that's what Jesus is emphasizing here. And you could tie that in with Matthew 23 when he criticizes these same Pharisees as being whited sepulchers or graves that are painted on the outside and they look nice. The Jews kept up their cemeteries. But inwardly, what's on the inside of that sarcophagus? Full of dead men's bones. So he said, that's what the Pharisees are like. They look good, but inside, they're not good. He said, don't be like them. I'm going to show you how to be truly righteous. So here in chapter 5, you have the emphasis on true righteousness. And now the main section you have in Matthew 5. Let me put these verses up there because I'll go fast and you might not keep up with me. But if you want to mark something in Matthew 5, then here are this key phrase that Jesus uses again and again would be a good place to start. I've just underlined the first part of these verses, beginning in verse 21 where he says, ye have heard that it was said by them of old time. This is what you've been taught, but let me tell you how it really is. You see, a good way to teach is to contrast error with truth. Because that way people can see it. If you just preach truth and you never mention error, some people will never make the connection. Oh, wait a minute. But when you show what is error and then you show what the truth is, it's easy to make the contrast. And a person can make the choice which one of those is right. And then they can reject what is wrong and be pleasing to God. That's what Jesus did here. You've heard that it hath been said, verse 21. You see it again in verse 27, the first part of the verse. You have heard that it hath been said of them of old time. And then you see it again in verse 33. Again, you have heard that it hath been said by them of old time. And then again in verse 38. You have heard that it hath been said, and then again in verse 43, you have heard that it hath been said. So Jesus is going through, he's setting the record straight. If you were going to plant a garden, if some of you did plant gardens earlier this year, you don't just go out there and throw the seed on the top of the ground. You have to prepare the soil first. You have to remove the obstacles. So you may have had to cut down a tree and remove the stump. You may have moved rocks out of the way. That's what Jesus is doing here. There are a lot of barriers to people understanding what true righteousness is, and he's moving the rocks out of the way. He's saying, you've heard this, but this is not right. This is what's right. And so there's a contrast made. It would be interesting, instructive, to go a level deeper into that and see what those contrasts are, but we won't do that. You can do that on your own. Let's move then into chapter 6. If chapter 5 is true righteousness, then chapter 6 is personal righteousness. This emphasis upon the heart. I wanted to mention 15:8 because that's a good theme verse for chapter 6. By contrast, when he's dealing again with these Pharisees, but he says, this people draweth nigh unto me with their mouth and honoreth me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. That's a good theme verse to consider before reading Matthew chapter 6. In this, he just takes certain categories of our response to God, our personal religion. And he's going to talk about public religion in the next chapter. But chapter 6 is your personal religion. And he goes through these five areas. Our alms or our giving. Well, they made a show out of it. You know, they would make sure somebody was looking before they gave their contribution to the poor guy out on the street corner. They had the trumpets in the temple where they were called the trumpets because they were made out of metal. And whenever you made an offering, you put it in and it would ding, 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 ding as it went down. And so everybody would hear it and people would notice. Well, Jesus said, that's not the way to give. Don't even let your right hand know what your left hand's doing. You know, you keep that quiet. You don't make a show out of it. And then God will reward you for it. But if you make a show out of it, you've already gotten your prize or your reward, your recognition from others. So, personal righteousness. Then he talks about prayer in verses 5 to 15, a very famous section of Jesus' teaching on the model prayer and things related to it. All of it's not the model prayer, but that's a beautiful section. It deals with, again, the personal righteousness. Fasting, chapter 6, 16 through 18. When you fast, don't let people know it. You know, don't wear your worst clothes and, you know, not comb your hair or shave or, you know, well, what's wrong? Oh, he's fasting. No, don't let people know. And then what about our treasures? Lay up your treasures in heaven, 19 to 24. And then what about our response to life's troubles? Oh, worry. He said, don't worry. God will take care of you. Verses 25 to 34. So there's personal righteousness. That's how faith reacts at this very basic level of a man's religion, a woman's religion, how they respond to God. It's all from the inside out. Now, what about chapter 7 then? Chapter 5, true righteousness. Chapter 6, personal righteousness. Well, then chapter 7, you have practical righteousness. That is, how religion affects others, those that we come in contact with. Verses 1 through 12, I would call social righteousness, because this is how we react to others in connection, in a community connection. And verse 12 would summarize everything that he said. You know, love God with all your heart and then love man as yourself. Well, how do you love man as yourself? The golden rule. Treat others like you want to be treated. Whatsoever you would that men should do unto you, do even so unto them. So that's the social aspect of a man's, a woman's religion, to treat others the way they should be treated. And then verses 13 and 27, the second half of that chapter, I would call preparatory righteousness, because he's talking about how to be right with God before the judgment day. And that's a very famous part of this sermon too, when he talks about, enter ye in at the straight gate, for wide is the gate, broad is the road that leads to destruction, many there be that go in thereat, because straight is the gate, narrow is the way that leadeth in life, few there be that find it. 7, 13 and 14. And then he says in 21 and 23, many will say to me in that day, Lord, have we not? And they'll brag, you know, they'll say what they did, and he'll say, I never knew you. Well, who are the ones he's going to know? You see, we need to be prepared for that. He that doeth the will of my Father which is in heaven. That's what he's going to be looking for, is our obedience, our submission, our understanding of the will of God and our willingness to do what it is that God asks of us. So that's preparatory righteousness. And then the very last part of that chapter deals with the famous story the children sing about, but it's really not a children's lesson, although they need to know it, about the wise man and the foolish man. Are you building your life on the rock, or are you building your life on the sand? And it might not show for a long time, but ultimately, the house built on the sand will fall. It will not stand up in the judgment day. But the house built on the rock, the teachings of Jesus, that will stand. And it will prepare us for the judgment day. So the conclusion to this section, verses 28 and 29, it came to pass when Jesus had ended these sayings, the people were astonished at his doctrine. For he taught them as one having authority and not as the scribes. The scribes would get up and read in a monotone the writings or the sayings of the old rabbis. And you could picture how boring that would be. Jesus didn't preach like that. When Jesus preached, he engaged people. He made it practical. And so the people loved his preaching, and they were astonished at him, and he was a powerful preacher because the people listened when he preached. All right, that's that section. We've dealt with the introduction to Matthew, those first four chapters. Now we've dealt with what Jesus taught, or his words, what he said, verses chapters 5 through 7. And now, let's talk about, we won't be able to finish this section, but let's talk about what Jesus wrought, what he did, chapters 8 through 10. There are 12 miracles here. I've been debating on how to cover this. I think what I'll do first with you is just let you mark the 12 miracles. If you mark your Bible or make a note about where they are, what I have done in my Bible is just to put a box around a word or a phrase that represents that miracle. Like, for instance, in verse 2, I put a box around the word leper, because here's where Jesus heals the leper. And then at a glance, which is what I'm about to do, I can find those really quickly. And you could do the same if you mark your Bible. If you remember Jesus' miracle about, you know, healing the demon possessed man. Well, you can find that really quickly if you intelligently mark your Bible. So I'll go through really quickly and let you mark the phrases or the words, and then we'll go back and look at a little bit of detail with them. So mark leper in verse 2. In verses 5 and 6, this one's a little bit more complicated, but I marked the word centurion. I put a box around centurion in verse 5 and the word servant in verse 6, because that's what it's about. He heals the centurion's servant. So, box around the word centurion, verse 5, and the word servant in verse 6. The next one is found in verse 14. It also is sort of divided, but I put a box around the word Peter and wife's mother in that verse. Peter's wife's mother. So Peter's mother-in-law is healed of a fever. The next one is found in 16. box around healed all that were sick in the last part of that verse. And then in begins in 23, it's in verse 26, rebuked the winds is what I marked. So that's when he stills the storm, rebuked the winds. And then 28, these words, two possessed with devils. So he cast out demons. The next one is in verse 2 of the next chapter, which is man sick of the palsy. Chapter 9, verse 2, man sick of the palsy. The next one is chapter 9, verse 18. Ruler, daughter, ruler's daughter. Those words are not connected in, but they are. That's the main idea. So just mark those two. The next one is in verse 20 of chapter 9. A woman, issue of blood. A woman, issue of blood. That's also separated, but those are the key words. The next one is in verse 27 of chapter 9, 9:27, two blind men. Put a box around two blind men. The next one is verse 32, a box around dumb or mute man, depending on your translation. King James, dumb man meaning couldn't speak, those two words. I believe that's 12. So that should be the miracles. There's some other things that you may want to mark as we go back through that. But that's the key idea in this section. These 12 miracles that Jesus did. And each one of them shows that Jesus had authority or power over a different area. Demon possession, nature, and different various kinds of diseases and sicknesses. So I'll give you those as we go through too. I'll go ahead and... We won't be able to finish all these. We just have 5 minutes. But I'll go ahead and do these first two. The leper in chapter 8, verses 2 to 4, shows that Jesus had power over contagious disease. Now, the book of Leviticus talks about, under the law of Moses, if a person had leprosy, they would go to the priest, and he would look at the sore when it first came up, and he put them in quarantine for a week, and then come back, show it to me again. And then if, according to how it had either healed or not healed, the characteristics of it, he would say, it's not leprosy, and you can go back to your normal life. Or if it was leprosy, they would be quarantined. So once a person was diagnosed as having leprosy, he had no social interaction, no touching, any other. He hadn't had a hug from his wife. His child had not crawled up into his lap. He hadn't shaken hands with any person who walked down the street. He would have to say, unclean, unclean. And you could see the circle of people who would just part like the Red Sea as he walked down a street because no one wanted to get leprosy, and it was a contagious disease. And so Jesus, in this chapter, though, it says, verse 2, there came a leper and worshipped him, saying, Lord, if thou wilt, thou canst make me clean. And Jesus put forth his hand and did what? He touched him. He had not been touched a year, 10 years. I don't know how long he had had it. He had not felt the warmth of human touch until Jesus touched him. Now, what people feared was that the disease would go from the sick person to the well person. Jesus touched him, and the healing went from the well person to the sick person. Jesus was more powerful than the leprosy. So it transferred from him. See, it was reversed what normally would be expected. I really love, I'd never seen this before last week when I was reading this again. Don't you love the Bible when you read it? You read something, you know, a dozen, 100 times, however many. And then you say, I never saw that before. Isn't it beautiful? Here in this first part, Jesus put forth his hand and touched him and said, I will. I love those two words. He says them again in verse 7, I will. Somebody asks of Jesus, Jesus doesn't say no, he says yes. He doesn't say, I can. He says, I can. I will. I will, be thou clean. And immediately the leprosy was cleansed. Well, that had never been seen before. I mean, you got leprosy, you were a dead man walking. I mean, there was no cure for it. And even till today, certain kinds of leprosy, they can slow it down, but they can't cure it. But Jesus touched him, he was immediately clean. And he said, go and show yourself to the priest. That's what, you know, the priests were the ones that determined whether you were a leper or not. So Jesus, fulfilling the law, said, you need to go show yourself to the priest and let him, you know, go through the channels and he'll say you're clean. You'll be able to interact with people again. Well, that's all I'm going to be able to talk about. So we'll pick up there. I don't know if I'll do it tonight or a couple weeks from now. Next week is Darien. Those of us who are going to Darien, and Brandon will be preaching. And then the week after that, I will be preaching the Sunday morning, Sunday night. So we'll either come back to it at that point, depending on how much we cover in the sermon today, what we'll cover tonight. Thanks for your attendance and your attention this morning. We'll be dismissed until the worship hour.